Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Sugar Maple Traditional Music Festival, July 31st and August 1st in Madison, with music workshops, camping, kids' activities, and performances by J.D. Crow in the New South, Robbie Folks, and more. Ticket info at sugarmaplefest.org. Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. We're going to be talking about bugs and the insect kingdom with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison Professor of Entomology, and he is found at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Phil, it's a pleasure to have you back in the studio.
Nice to be here, Jim.
You've just had a couple of days at Farm Progress Days, or Wisconsin Farm Technology Days, I guess, as it's known now.
Right, my 31st show, so been doing it for a while, and it was interesting, you know, being in the southern part of the state. Probably the biggest question that was coming in was Japanese beetles, people who are just starting to experience it or only had a couple years of misery from those critters eating their roses and their birch trees, but we always have some interesting things coming in, and emerald ash borer was a big topic for a lot of people. They're seeing the purple traps out there and the like, and just kind of wondering, you know, where that's all going. So,
well, Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection say they'd hung nearly 7,000 of the sticky purple traps in the ash trees across the state. Have you heard anything about what they're finding?
I think people probably picked up this week that Crawford County officially had their first ones caught in traps, and that's just, you know, looks to be part of that population in Vernon County. The traps really won't be totally collected for till the end of summer, and it'll take some time to get through it. So, you know, we probably won't have a good handle, but I will tell you that I am changing from optimistic to more pessimistic as we get these infestations. You know, they're starting to happen, and when we find them, they're so big, and I was just hoping that the spread of this thing would be slower, but I'm starting to get the feeling that it is going to be relatively quick.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest, and if you'd like to join in, we have a couple of lines open this morning at 1-800-642-1234, and of course, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Kiana in Madison for our first call. And good morning. How are you?
Oh, good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks. So I have a question about raspberries. I have a nice abundant crop this year, and as I'm keeping up on picking, I occasionally come across a berry that tastes awful, and I'm wondering if it's a bug that is getting into some of the berries. And it's a real common flavor. I've tasted it for years. It doesn't matter which patch we're in. I'm sure you've probably tasted it as well. You know, it's the kind of flavor, it's kind of musty tasting, and makes you want to spit out the berry and get some more, you know, sweet berries in your mouth to get that flavor out of your mouth. Is that a bug?
It likely could be. To be honest, stink bug feeding is notorious for causing that kind of off flavor on strawberries. So that would be my guess. And the problem is the critter's gone. This is a sucking insect, and I'm not even sure what the dynamic is of why it changes the chemistry of the berry. But as I said, that is a typical symptom of stink bug feeding on raspberries, is that they taste off.
Uh-huh. So it leaves its juices, its digestive juices, and the bug is gone, but the digestive juices is what gives it that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's changing the chemistry, because, I mean, this insect, being a liquid feeder, has to liquefy its food, and so it is injecting enzymes in there. And as I said, even when the critter's gone, you know, sometimes on younger berries, they won't even color correctly, or they'll be deformed. But that is a classic of stink bugs.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Kivana. I appreciate hearing from you. You can join in with your question as well at 1-800-642-1234 or our email address, talk@wpr.org. And Phil, how would you characterize the mosquito populations in Wisconsin this summer?
It depends where you are. It was interesting that we had a conference call this morning among extension agents and whatnot. We do this every Thursday. And in Green Bay and whatnot, they've had very little rain for really weeks on end. And so when you have that scenario, they don't have mosquitoes. They have spider mites and all these droughty things. What we experience in a lot of the southern part of the state is we had a very heavy rainfall incident about mid-June. 10 days later, it pushed, and so the mosquitoes just before the 4th of July started to really pick up. And for about a week to 10 days, it was kind of intense. But again, we've been getting on the dry side, and so it had started to subside in most places, unless, again, they've had one of these isolated storms. We had a storm that came through in Walworth County yesterday. They had 2.5 inches in a very small area. I guarantee those people within 10 days, they're going to see a flush down there, but it will be a very localized thing. So I haven't seen anything unusual. They were a little late in coming. You know, the cool weather has kind of slowed them up. But normally, you know, we have not, last year when we had that heavy rain in June, the mosquitoes picked up. But, you know, my perspective growing up in Wisconsin, the last few years, the mosquitoes have been on the light side, not the heavy side.
Is there any new product or are there any new products on the market designed to keep mosquitoes away?
Well, what there are alternatives. You know, there's a soybean oil treatment called Bite Blocker. There's a product which is lemon eucalyptus oil, which is a repellent that's been used in Europe for a number of years and has been now registered in the United States for about the last 3 or 4 years. There's another on Picardin, which is another European species or product. And so there are options other than DEET. Now, you know, DEET is the old standby. It still is probably the gold standard that everything else is compared to. But if people are looking for other options, there are products. And, you know, they'll last anywhere from 20 minutes to 2 to 3 hours, depending on the product, the concentration, how much you sweat. And the whole concept with all of this is the mosquitoes don't like to land on you when you have it in an area. But if you get to treat the back of your neck, they'll find it.
We were up around the Boulder Junction area over the 4th of July and hiked the Star Lake Trail. And two of the people who accompanied my wife and I on this hike had the kind of device that clips on to your pocket and is supposed to keep you free of mosquito.
It does, although if you understand how it works, in this case, it is an insecticide. It is a synthetic pyrethroid insecticide, and it is on a little patch, and they have a little butene, if it's the one I'm thinking of, the Thermocell-type product. A little butane container, and they basically heat a coil, and they put this on it, and what it causes it to do is volatilize. So you've got this little cloud of insecticide. It does take a little time to build up. The only concern to some degree is if you're walking real quick, the cloud's left behind you.
That's what I was wondering, because it was kind of breezy, too.
Yeah, and so, you know, it does work quite well in the right circumstances, but you have to understand its limitations.
Let's go back to the phones, take another call, and that would be Susan in Bristol. Hello, Susan. What's on your mind today? Susan.
Are you talking to me? I'm not Susan.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a Susan.
Who are you then?
Saul and Stevens Point.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I just had a question. Do you know of any amateur entomology or insect collecting publications?
If they're still on the web, and I assume they are, there is an organization out of Michigan called YES, which stands for Young Entomological Society. And they have, it's almost like a club. I know they have a magazine they used to give out. But one of the things, too, is they have all kinds of appropriate books for various age groups and other insect stuff. And I would suggest to go to their site. Another place that you can get some pretty good stuff, there's a company called BioQuip out of California that sells insect nets and cabinets and all kinds of lab supplies. But they have a rather extensive library also. Some of it probably more for people that are you know, for professionals, but they also have quite a bit of things. So between the YES group and BioQuip people, I think you can find a number of things. And depending on the child's interest, you know, if they're butterflies, they have specific books to that or more general entomology, but that's where I would start.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I think we finally located Susan there in Bristol. Hello, Susan.
Hello. Do I sound like a female now?
You do sound like a female.
Thank you for taking my call. I have an identification issue, and I don't know if these insects are any kind of a problem-causing insect or what they are. I've lived in this area my whole life, which is 50 years, never seen them before in my life till the last 2 weeks. And there are these flying green. They're very light green. They're very delicate-looking, and they look like grasshoppers. And they've been just, like, clouding over the sides of different buildings, like convenience stores and houses and restaurants, and I've just never seen them before and have no idea what they are.
How big, lengthwise?
They're like maybe slightly longer than 1 inch. And they look like very delicate grasshoppers and very, very pale green. But they obviously flew up there. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, grasshoppers, you know, have those very distinctive hind legs that they jump with and usually are more robust. You know, if they were much smaller, I'd say they're lake flies, but these sound big enough. I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing mayflies because we get some mass emergences, and we have had of those. in parts of the state in the last couple weeks, and there are some species that go on the green side. They have little long tails, though, that stick out, which is usually distinctive.
Well, they're just built kind of like a grasshopper. They're long and they're slender, you know, as far as their length is concerned. They're not round like any kind of a beetle.
Okay, no, well, that would fit lake flies. And the other possibility, well, see, if they're more moth-like, I'd say they might be caddis flies. But I would just do on the internet, just do a Google search on mayflies, and you know, don't worry about the color, because a lot of them are brown and black, but there are some green forms, and just see if that's fitting a little bit more.
Yeah.
By nature, they're strongly attracted to light, so they're often drawn into buildings, especially, you know, gas stations and other things that have lighting on. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Are those the same ones that are like these little, when they're larvae, they're green with the black head, and they hang out on evergreen trees, and when you go and scare them, they all turn their head at the same time?
No, those are sawflies, and they turn into something that looks more like a little fly, really. And no, the aquatic mayflies and lake flies and caddis flies all live in water, lakes and streams, and so they've got maggot-like larvae, and then the adults emerge and are usually very short-lived animals.
Do they cause any problem for anything? See, now, what you're saying makes sense, because where I've seen them mostly is in Silver Lake, so it's right around the water.
No problem, other than, you know, the classic one, and it's, you know, in fact, when I was on Farm Technology Day, somebody had mentioned to me that it was going on, is La Crosse gets a mayfly species that comes off the river there that is so intense that either they have to shut the lights off on the bridges, or, to be honest, they take the snow plows out to basically brush them off the road, because if you don't, the road gets greasy from all the dead mayflies that are there. I mean, we're talking 2 and 3 inches deep, and so it really is quite a phenomenon when they have a big year.
Yeah, no, this just amazed me, because, I mean, I accidentally killed 3 of them just by opening the door to a gas station because they were on the handle. They were so thick on the side of the building.
Yeah, and they're very fragile little critters, and in fact, to be honest, they don't eat at all. Their whole purpose, whether anything, doesn't matter what the situation is, they live for 24 to 48 hours at best and then just die.
Susan, thank you so much, and good luck to you in that identification. Let's go to Sue in Appleton next. Hi, Sue.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I've got boxwoods, and some of the leaves are curling in, and I had assumed they were in need of water, but I was told they could be spider mites, and I've treated them last Thursday and today with a 3-in-1 rose treatment. I'm wondering if those sound like spider mites. I opened up the leaf, and there was like a little white, cottony-looking web, and then, sure enough, a tiny little brown bug kind of fell out.
Okay. Now, probably doesn't sound like spider mites. I mean, what spider mites look like are walking dust. They're very small, and usually if you shake an infested plant over a white piece of paper, that's what you see, is the dust starts to move around. And you know, under a microscope, they look like very small ticks. They have 8 legs on them. And the way I describe their damage is it starts as almost like a sandblasting or a yellow spotting on the leaves, and that physical damage causes the leaf to dry up and brown. And so ultimately the symptom in the end can look very similar, but when you open the leaves up and seeing something that's big enough to see without any magnification and also the fuzziness, it's something else. Now, you said this was boxwood?
Yeah, boxwood. And the leaves aren't turning a different color. They're still green. They're just hard and round, and then I opened them up, and a little brown bug was in there with the leaves.
There's a couple unique insects on boxwood. There is a critter called a boxwood psyllid, PSYLLID. I'm suspicious that's what it is, because the way they lay their eggs, the little critters develop within the leaf, and so it can have almost a gall-like structure. It eventually will turn kind of yellowish and whatnot, but I wonder if you have the psyllid. If indeed that's the critter, the treatment used was not a bad choice, but the timing is not so good. It really, you have to go on quite early to kind of catch it just as it's starting rather than this late in the game.
Okay, so will it do any good to treat it now, and or will they kill my boxwood?
Won't kill it. I'd make it look a little bit on the thin and shabby side. I would suggest that next year, probably about mid-May, would be the time I would try to treat it, because that's when things are starting to go, and I think then, you know, the plant will recover and fill in over time. So it's definitely not life or death, but it can be a pretty significant cosmetic injury if they're there in enough numbers.
Okay, so should I stop the rose 3-in-1 at this point?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to gain much anymore. You put the one application on, so you've probably got as good effect as you can. And as I said, just keep it around and somehow mark in the calendar to treat those plants, you know, mid to late spring next year.
Sue, thank you so much for the call. If you'd like to join in, the number 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison Professor of Entomology, and he hangs out at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network. A reminder that you can join our online community of listeners by going to WPR.org, scrolling down to community, clicking on Larry Mueller's picture. Tomorrow on Garden Talk after 11, our guest will be Kristen Krukowski, Waukesha County Extension Commercial Horticulture Educator. And one of the online questions that Larry asks is, what is your favorite garden plant and why? And you can go there now, or you can go there tomorrow morning, or even during the show. So we'd like to hear from you at WPR.org. Phil Pelletieri, a guest again, and let's go to Rick and Thorpe. Rick, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I've got a pretty simple question. I've been noticing those little white and yellow butterflies you see along the roads all the time. There used to be tons of them, and I have seen very few this year, especially the yellow ones. I don't think I've seen hardly any. Is there a decline in them, or what are they? I don't even know what they are for sure. If they're a moth, I'm sure they're a butterfly, but I don't know.
The most common yellow butterfly we have here is something I call alfalfa caterpillar, although there's more than one species, or they call them sulfur butterflies because of the color. The white one often turns out to be the imported cabbage worm, which is the critter that lays its eggs and gives you your green worms on your broccoli and cabbage. In general, it has not been a good year for butterflies. Some of this, I think the coolness, sometimes we just have kind of patterns that promote a lot of diseases. The monarchs were so late in getting up here, but we didn't have that strong southerly airflow. I mean, if you sit back and think about the climate and what's been happening, I guess I'm not surprised, maybe a good way of putting it. So I agree with you. It has been not a good year. In general, if I had to make some generalizations, usually the hotter years that are a little on the drier side seem to be better butterfly years. And that wouldn't describe what it is. Even the areas of the state that are dry, it's been cool. And so now things can change very quickly. Some of the butterflies we have here, including those species, go through more than one generation. So if the cards start falling their way, you will see a resurgence quite quickly. But in general, of the 150 odd species that we have in the state, they're not having a good year.
Okay, so there isn't a general decline in them. It just seems like over the last few years, I've seen less and less. Your car used to be just covered with them when you've been driving down the road, the front of them, and you just don't see that many anymore.
Yeah, no, and as I said, they have the capacity to resurge pretty quickly. There's nothing specifically. In fact, the imported cabbage worm doesn't belong here. I'm not sure about the coleus species, if they're an early introduction or not. They're not that much of a pest species, and we do see them in alfalfa, and to be honest, usually when they start to build in the late summer, there's a virus disease that usually knocks their populations down.
Okay, thank you.
Rick, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We've heard from Nan, who says, hey, Phil, any ideas on what could be providing a food source for larder beetles in an upstairs room without any storage or food source that we can think of? Mm-hmm. No food products in the house seem infested, and as far as we can tell, there are no woolens or organic materials near the room. We're stumped. Could it be something outside or in the attic that we don't have access to, in the walls, vents? Nothing smells funny or provides any obvious clues, and it's limited to the one room.
Okay. Well, larder beetle is in the carpet beetle family, but what makes and where the name is derived is they need a high protein food source. And so I do see them in old greasy dog food bags that people forgot about, and they can breed, and they've got these little brown fuzzy larvae that get up to almost an inch long. What's distinctive about the adult beetle, it's black and it has this brown vest right around the middle of it. It's very distinctive. But they can breed on old carrion, so something as innocent as a mouse in your wall can breed a couple dozen larder beetles. And, you may not smell that, but when the adults start to get active, they fall into the living space. Another common source of food is for people that have Asian lady beetle and cluster fly or box elder bug problems. Many of those insects will die in the wall voids, and then that's a protein source that will breed larder beetles. So for people that have recurring larder beetle problems, that's usually what the story is they get the fall migration of insects in, the insects die, and that makes food for the larder beetles. And so you know, you solve one of the problems, you solve two. But if it's something just kind of all of a sudden, very localized, as I said, then I think it's something as innocent as a dead bird or a dead mouse from quite some time ago. They don't get on fresh carrion. They get on older, dried carrion. And the name comes from the fact that they used to be a pest of dried meats. You know, back when we had, you know, salted pork and that kind of stuff, you had to be careful because larder beetles would try to take advantage of something like that.
To the phones we go, and Bob in Sun Prairie is next. Hello, Bob.
Yes, hi. I have a nice raspberry patch, and I'm picking up a few of these Japanese beetles now with a silver top on them, like three maybe a day. Last night I got about seven I caught. But I'm still getting really good fruit. It's just starting to really come now. I'm getting like a half a pail or better of ice cream pail of fruit. Will, if I don't do anything, will they actually ruin the plant or the crop?
Not with those numbers. You know, plants can tolerate a lot more leaf chewing than most people, and they're not a fruit pest. They're basically a leaf feeder. Yeah. And your numbers are very low. Unfortunately, if I had to make a prediction over time, maybe not this year, but in years, later years, I would not be surprised if the numbers go up, because that's the typical pattern. And it's really frustrating on raspberries, probably more so than any crop, because first of all, Japanese beetles love them. Secondly, they're coming on just when the fruit is ripening. And I've got a lot of insecticides that will kill them. But if I tell you to spray something and you can't pick for 7 days, that's not what we want to do. And so, you know, it really kind of handcuffs us. But, you know, a couple things that people consider when the numbers get higher than what you're seeing. And hand picking is very reasonable for the low numbers you see, but when you get higher, some people will use floating row covers, or I talked to a couple people at the technology days that had bought rather inexpensive bridal veil material, sewed it together, and used that as a physical barrier around their raspberries so the Japanese beetles couldn't get to the plants. There's an organic insecticide called neem that is an anti-feedant. They don't like the way it tastes, and you know, it helps keep them off the leaves during this picking season, and neem does not, from what I can remember, have any harvest restriction involved with it. And so you could spray it and not have to worry about waiting a few days before you can pick berries. So so it's something to watch. Right now, as I said, I wouldn't even recommend the neem. I don't think the numbers are high enough. When they really get going, you know, people will call me and tell me there's not a leaf left on the raspberries. I mean, it can get that intense, and you got 20 beetles on every leaf. And in that case, that's when you wonder about they will weaken the plant enough that it will affect fruit production over the long run.
Okay. When I pick those off, I've heard gentlemen say that have some soapy water or something and just throw them in there because the scent, if you squash them.
Will draw more? Not quite. What's interesting is that the females do give off a chemical that draws the males in, and so they do have a tendency to gang up on plants when the females are around. But I don't worry so much about the crushed. It's just a convenience thing. You know, sometimes I've just collected them in an old plastic bottle, and they fall in there. And to be honest, if exposed to the sun during the day, they'll die rather shortly. The soapy water, I think, is just a convenient thing. You knock them in there, and they'll die pretty shortly in short order. But you can crush them, too. There's no problem with that.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much. I was looking at a story that appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal about earwigs around this time to bug gardeners. And there was a quote in there that says, if you're really desperate, the best way to get rid of earwigs is to treat them like a disobedient child, deny them their supper. That's the reporter's statement, apparently.
Yeah, that would not be my quote. My quote for earwigs, to be honest, is if you don't want to make your backyard a sandbox, because that would be the kind of environment that they cannot survive in. But no, that doesn't sound like a quote for me, because it really... You know, they're omnivorous, which is kind of interesting. They feed on a wide variety of both plant and insects. So there's a slight beneficial side. They love marigolds and those kind of things. So you can be a little selective if, you know, in what you plant, that you'll have less earwig damage. But aside from the ornamental plant damage, the other big complaint we get is of them migrating indoors. And I tell people they can't breed indoors. They don't hurt anything indoors. It's just people don't like these ugly brown bugs that are running around. And you do have that trouble when you talk to the press at times that it's not the first time I have had a quote associated with me that didn't come from me. One of the classic ones I remember, and we were talking about cockroaches on campus, and the quote the reporter used was, cockroaches and students go together like peanut butter and jelly. And, you know, it's true that in student housing we have a bit of an issue at times, but it is not just because they're students. And as I said, that was not my quote, but unfortunately, it was pinned on me. But yeah, I said I would not talk about depriving children of food. That's not quite the way I would word things.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you as we talk with Phil Pelletieri from the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. And I know that from time to time you invite people to take photographs of insects that they can't identify. Are you still looking at photos?
It is now 40% of what I see in the lab, whether we get them from the county extension offices that usually have cameras there, or again, people just seeing interesting things. And so it is the quickest way. And again, I know my colleague, Brian Huddleston, who runs the plant disease lab, will tell you, you take a picture of a dead plant or a dying plant, usually he can't see the things he needs to see. But if you can get an insect in decent focus, I can usually give you a pretty good shot of what I think it is and the like. And so, you know, I say this to a lot of people, that the digital camera was the greatest invention in my career as far as, you know, being able to work with things, and both from me being able to take pictures of neat things that are going on, but the other side of people being able to take pictures of things they see in their backyard, email them to me, and I can get them a quick answer.
So if they go to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, they'll be able to do that?
Yes. My email is posted both on the department website and there. And you know, we have the insect ID section, so, you know, sometimes you can kind of scroll through that and see, you know, I've got some of the more common things listed. You know, we have about 18,000 species of insects in the state, and so you will always run into things that I don't have on my website. But and so that's a great use of the camera is take a picture of this odd looking thing, and we'll see what we can come up with.
I bet you, if you asked most people, would not be able to tell you how many thousands of insects there are in the state.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This question just came up. A colleague in Iowa had asked in the Midwest what kind of numbers, and I had to do a little bit of digging. To be honest, being Italian, I tend to embellish things, so I thought it was more in the 20s, but when we checked, Michigan has some data, Illinois has some data, and my colleague Dan Young had some pretty good figures, and so that's the kind of the general running list that we have is 18,000 species, which pretty much outweighs the plants, birds, anything else you can come up with. You might be able to argue there's more bacteria out there, but I'm not even sure that the microbiologist would state that.
Back to the phones to Marilyn in Wausau. Hello, Marilyn.
Good morning.
And go ahead.
We own some rental properties, and one of the rental properties, one of our tenants contacted us that they had a bed bug problem. I thought this was something that wasn't around for the last 20, 40 years. We did a lot of checking on the internet and so forth. Could you give us some information?
Sure. It has become a major nightmare in the last 8 to 10 years. I agree with you. I mean, the way I tell the story is if I used to see a human bed bug, there is a species associated with bats. And I've seen a trickle of those every year, but the human bed bug problem has just exploded. I mean, to epidemic. There's no other way, with a capital E, in fact. The main reason is that they are resistant to the standard treatments and tools that are used by people or the pest control. And so they're difficult to control. And often it's very hard to see how they got in. I mean, if you had a new tenant that moved in and a week later they reported bed bugs and you'd never seen them before, you speculate that they brought them with them. But the problem is if somebody's been there for a while and they show up, it's very difficult to tell. In multiple family units, They're spreading like roaches. You get them in unit A and they'll spread to the people above, below, and to the side in relatively short order. And the treatments are very expensive, which is, you know, a real dilemma for everybody involved. And the treatments don't always work. It isn't unusual when you contract for service that people say we'll have to come out 2 to 3 times minimum to try to treat for it. They're using various heat treatments and some other technologies now that maybe can just be used once. But the bottom line is when a lot of landlords hear the price, they're very fearful. And so it will be a wrestling match. I'll be honest with you, there aren't very many cases where I say you have to get professional help, but this is one I think I would. There are mattress casings you can put on. As you're probably picking up on the internet, there's some drying dust we can use. But if you've got a moderate infestation, as I said, I think it's, even though it's an expensive treatment, it's worth getting somebody to come in. And my other piece of advice is talk to pest control people to see if they've got experience. I knew we were in trouble when people that I highly respect in that industry who had not dealt with bed bugs, I mean, you know, the first time it's a kind of a learning curve, would try to solve a problem and they couldn't. You know, and right away, that to me is a red flag that there's something more going on here than just, you know, and then what it was is the resistance factor, which our colleagues at, in Kentucky have told us that it's a 1,500-fold resistance to the pesticides that are commonly used, which basically means they don't work.
Yeah.
We tried different, we contacted the internet, and we did order some product through the internet, and...
Well, you know what, the dilemma here is a couple fold. You know, there are some drying dust, there are some mattress encasements which help out quite a bit. But one of the things that we're learning about bed bugs is they can be almost anywhere. So you have to be incredibly thorough. To be honest, there's other things like box springs. You almost have to totally disassemble to treat. I mean, you know, it's not an easy thing, and that's where the experience tends to help. And the other thing though is you also need to have some help from the tenants. You know, bagging things up, getting away of clutter. I mean, if people got lots of cardboard boxes and other things stored in the bedroom on top of it, it makes life almost impossible to control it. That's been one of the advantages of the heat treatments. They come in with this machine and generate 140 degrees within the room, and they cook them out. So there it's not quite as critical, but then the question is, are you sure you're getting that temperature in absolutely every nook and cranny? Because, you know, we're finding bed bugs in the ceiling on the opposite side of, in curtain rods, in stereo speakers, and in places that you normally wouldn't treat or tend to look for them.
Marilyn, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Alrighty, thank you.
Appreciate your call. The number 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri about bugs and insects. Randy in Superior is next. Hello, Randy.
Hello. Say, I've got these white grubs in my garden.
Okay, and how old is the garden? Is it a new garden or an older garden?
It's probably 8 years old.
Okay, and have you put any kind of organic mulch, manure,
yes,
those kind of things in there?
Yes.
To be honest, they're probably not the plant root-feeding type of grub, but they're a species... The scarab beetle is a big family of beetles. In the true white grubs, which are associated with lawns and also doing some minor damage in potatoes and other root crops. But the reason I asked about the age of the garden is they are usually a problem the first year or two of a garden. And then in an established garden, the females don't lay their eggs because there's no grass there, and so we don't have a problem. But if you get decaying organic matter, it's quite common to get other, what we would call dung beetles, come in and lay their eggs, and those grubs would feed on that and really help recycle the nutrients, and they won't feed on your roots. And so my guess is with that history, you have a species that you don't have to worry about it's causing plant damage.
Okay.
And they all look the same. I mean, they're all, you know, C-shaped, white, with the brown heads. To be honest, to tell the difference, usually we have to put them under the microscope and look on the hairs and the spines on their posterior end, tell us if it's a plant-feeding species or it's a dung species. So it's something that would be very hard to describe unless you're used to looking at beetles, but the history of it really suggests, as I said, is the non-pest forms of these.
Oh, so I shouldn't have to worry about my potatoes then?
No, not with that history, because as I said, the white grubs that usually would feed into it. The first year or two of a garden, you got to be real careful because they have a 3-year life cycle. So the June beetle grubs, which causes the problems. They migrate down in the winter, and then in the spring they come up, and they would normally feed on the turf grass, but if there's no grass there, they'll get into your onions, your potatoes, your carrots, the root crop types of things.
Yeah.
And so that's where people see the damage.
Well, see, I put manure on my garden every year,
mm-hmm,
and my dad says they might be coming in on that.
Or even if they don't come in, as the manure breaks down, the beetles would lay their eggs and go from there. But they could come in with the manure. But as I said, they look the same. But one of the ways I can tell the difference, I've had people call me and tell me that they have 100 grubs per square foot, little tiny white grubs. I know those are the dung beetle species, the species that feed on the waste, because I've never seen regular white grubs that would come in that number. But if you were to tell me that you didn't put the animal waste, then I'd be scratching my head a little bit more. I might say, well, that would be worth sending in just for me to tell. But as I said, this fits the pattern so well, I don't think you've got anything to worry about.
All right, Randy, thank you so much, and good luck to you. We did receive some emails at talk@wpr.org, including, did you happen to catch the NBC newscast last week when they showed the tree trunk in Colorado completely red, supposedly covered with ladybugs? In your opinion, would they be ladybugs or the Asian beetles, which we have in the fall?
Well, Asian lady beetle is a ladybug. It is a non-native species, and we have about 40 species here. In Colorado, it could be a native species called Hippoderma convergens, or the convergent lady beetle. And what's a little odd is these clusterings are a common late fall. In fact, in the garden catalogs, you can buy lady beetles, and it's usually this convergent species. They're collected in the foothills of Arizona and California, where the lady beetles literally fly up to the higher ground, cluster like this, often in a tree trunk or some other kind of shelter place, and then in the spring and wake up, and they come back to the same site year after year. So the collectors know where these sites are, and of course they keep them secret. What we always tell people about this, though, is we have these species here already, so you're not gaining anything. And to be honest, the way lady beetles work when they wake up from the winter, they want to fly away anyway. It's hard to keep them in one spot. And so I think there's a good chance of it. What would be interesting is when that picture was taken. In the middle of summer, it's harder for me to explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of summer, when I hear about little red bugs clustering, I'm more inclined to think it's clusters of box elder bugs than lady beetles.
And we had an Angeline email us to say that she was inspecting a variety of willow that she's growing. And on the backside of some of the leaves were small, quarter-inch, oval, bright, cherry-red, waxy-looking raised spots. And she assumed that they were egg sacs of some sort.
Probably galls instead. So it's regular plant tissue. On willow, there's a couple, or not more than a couple. There's a number of insects, but there's some midges that we call gall midges that lay their egg in there, and you get this almost reddish bean-like growth. It's kind of solid, so almost like a little tumor might be another way of describing it. If you were to cut that very carefully, it would mostly be plant material, but in the center of it, there's often a little capsule, and there'd be a little maggot inside, and that's the developing critter. Now, what's interesting about galls is they can look very, very serious and the like, but they're purely cosmetic. And so nothing to worry about, and they kind of ebb and flow naturally in most cases. And there are literally hundreds of species of gall critters. We've got mites that do it. We've got wasps that do it quite commonly on oak trees. And we have a number of these midges. But as I said, in willow, I can't see it's anything to worry about. And as I said, you're seeing everything that's going to be there. The gall will eventually, if you watched it long enough, a small hole would appear, a little fly-like creature would fly away, and you're done with it.
To Rose in Menominee Falls. Next, hello, Rose.
Hello. I'm so glad to get on because I found a bug like I've never seen before. It was on my patio door screen, and it was approximately 2.5 inches long, kind of a narrow body, with a wide wingspan, looked like a dragonfly almost, the wings. The wings were copper-colored. The body was black and yellow striped, looked like a bee or wasp kind of thing. And then there was a half inch, I don't know, some people said it was a stinger and some people said it was a egg layer thing. And I've never seen anything like it. And I don't know if it was a member of a bee, could it be a queen or a...
Well, the long stinger, I was thinking, the size right away kind of restricts it to, you know, a couple dozen things. But if it has a long stinger-like structure, it probably is a parasitic wasp of wood-boring insects. Some of these things sometimes the stingers are longer than the body, but it's not a stinger, it's an egg-laying device. And what they use this is to drill a couple inches deep into the wood to lay their eggs so that their grubs can attack the wood-boring beetles or other creatures that are there. And so that would be my guess. It's either a wood wasp or a parasite of a wood wasp. It'd be one of the two things. Many insects are attracted to light, and so we do draw things at night, and, you know, some of them just kind of hang around on the screen in the day and kind of lay low in the day. But that would be my suspicion from what you describe. And as they said, they're harmless to people.
Okay. Is it going to lay a bunch of eggs? Am I going to be infested with something?
No. I mean, these things basically attack dead and dying trees in one form or another. And so, I could call them firewood insects to kind of give you an idea of their ecology, but definitely nothing to worry about. And, you know, whether this insect was there or not, these insects seem to find the dead wood, help recycle it, in that sense, and definitely nothing to worry about.
Last summer I had an infestation when I had an addition put on my house, when they took off the siding and the insulation underneath. There was an infestation of carpenter ants, and I had an exterminator come out and deal with those. And I know they also eat on dead wood or whatever.
Well, they don't eat on it, but they live in soft substrates. An old rotting stump is where they get their name from. Sometimes, though, you'll find that it's not, you know, it is often associated with wood that is softened in a house, so, you know, a bad window or the like, where there has been a leak. But I've also seen them in pink styrofoam and other things that are nothing to do with wood, but they're soft. And when they get in that soft stuff, they make it look like Swiss cheese. They kick out this debris, and so it looks like they're doing a lot of damage. The damage is really relatively minor in most cases, and again, they will not eat your house. That's not the way they work, but they will move into environments that are similar to that rotting stump out in nature is the way we describe it.
Okay.
All right, Rose, thanks very much there in Menominee Falls. Appreciate hearing from you. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard. We're talking with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you this morning on Wisconsin Public Radio. We had an email from Joanne in Eau Claire wondering if you could provide the lab address to mail insects to for diagnosis of what type of insects they are.
Sure.
Do they start off really by going to their county extension agent?
Well, I mean, the advantage if you can get to the local office is a lot of times if it's something common, they can identify it and you get a quick answer. And it depends on the county. I mean, some counties are more involved with this than others, have more support. So that would be the first place to start. And really, that's my first priority. When samples come in, it's the ones from the extension office I handle first and then work at it from there. But if you mail things in directly, the address is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison, and the university zip is 53706. And if you just send it to the insect lab, since I am the lab, there's nobody else there, I get it all. So it will be forwarded to me very quickly.
We also had an emailer from Jim who wondered how to get rid of earwigs. And I know that you've said that drowning them in beer is not what earwigs usually do.
Well, you know, the thing about it, you know, if they're getting indoors, the issue is that they're sneaking through something. And so the more you can caulk and tighten and seal, the better it is. The second thing to think about is they're probably sneaking in because of the plant foliage close to the house, and so the drier and the more open it is, the less they like it. If indeed the problem is they're just running all over the yard and eating all your marigolds, then the approach is, what I like the best is, and I usually don't go this way because of it's using a lot of chemical, but in this case it's needed. These hose end attachments you can buy, Ortho sells them, I'm sure other people do. And you put the chemical in the base of it, and you turn the hose on, and what that forces you to do is use a lot of volume. And in this case, you want to soak the mulch and soak the areas so that it is really going down to where the earwigs are hiding during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, usually a single treatment is very effective. But we're getting at that time of the year, you kind of say, well, you know, they've been out of the ground since Memorial Day. They've been there for 6 weeks. If you haven't had to treat them now, I often see by the middle of summer their numbers start to subside. And so... You know, if we were talking the 1st of June, I'd say, oh, boy, they can really be getting going for quite some time. But right now, the question is how bad are they? Do you really need to treat? They won't get any worse. They'll probably get better on their own.
To Dave in Green Bay next. Hello, Dave. What's on your mind?
Gentlemen, thank you. I was at a friend's cabin the other day up north by Coleman, and I got hit by a wasp. A cluster, there's a bunch of them, and I think it's a black wasp or a black jacket. I've never seen them before.
Well, the biggest common stinging wasp we have here is called a bald-faced hornet, which is mostly black, has a little white patch on the face and a little white patch on the tip of the abdomen. And, you know, comparatively, when one gets you, it's usually a pretty impressive sting. But, you know, I've got at least another 30 other stinging species of wasps and bees we could run into. But if it's big and somebody referred it to that would be my first guess, is it's a bald-faced hornet.
Was on the guide on the internet last night.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
I was on a bug guide.
Mm-hmm.
It's a website. And the closest thing on there identified, it's the size of a quarter in length.
Mm-hmm.
And the abdomen is striped in black and gray.
Okay.
And the thorax, or the top, has the white rim around the solid black on top, white rim. And there's two little white bars going down the back side of it.
Okay. Well, I mean, it still sounds like it could be a vespid, but, you know, when we get into a particular species, I probably would have to see it just because, you know, I have to look at the markings on the face and a couple other things. So uh-huh. I said, usually, though, the bigger, paper wasps. And the reason I had picked the baldface, it is the biggest species we have here. And did you find a nest, or did just one just kind of land on you and decide to pick on
they
you?
They had a nest in a wall.
Okay, well, then it wouldn't be baldface because they are aerial nesters. They're exposed nests. Then if we get into the in-ground one, Eastern yellow jacket, German yellow jacket, and we got three or four other species that it could fit. They're all in the genus Vespula. And so if you're on Bug Guide, that's kind of where I would kind of try to go through, because that is a common group. And it's interesting, the wasps have been quite quiet down here, but my colleague again up in Green Bay was telling me that they're getting a lot of wasp and bee calls. So the drier weather up there is usually results in higher populations. Now, did you take care of the ones in the wall? Are they gone or not?
Oh, they're gone. And there's a nest of another buzzing insect right next to them, which surprised me, just about another foot down the wall.
Okay.
Different species.
Well, you know, what I tell people, you know, when they have to deal with these things, anytime they go on the ground or a wall or whatnot, to be honest, we have better success with treating them with dust than sprays. Basically because the dust is in a form that when they come and go through the entrance, they get exposed. The problem with sprays is you see the hole they come and go from, but to be honest, the nest could be 10 feet away in the wall. You know, they could be working through the wall void, and so that's what makes those more problematic. The one thing I don't want to see people do is to plug the nest before they're dealt with, because that drives them inside and they get very agitated. And generally the problem is wasps are pretty tolerant unless the nests are threatened, and then they're very defensive.
This one was not tolerant. He saw my white glove waving around and went for it.
Okay. Well, Dave, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Roger next in Green Bay. Hello, Roger.
Hi there. Say, I've bought a house about 3 years ago, and I had centipedes in the basement. I found it after I moved in, of course. So I had Orkin showing up for about a year and a half trying to get rid of these centipedes, and they really didn't do anything. So I took over the treatment on my own, and I found... It's hard to find a treatment of like Menards or whatever for centipedes specifically, but I found Spectracide Bug Stop is.
Mm-hmm.
That seems somewhat useful for killing them, but they're still around after about a half a year of treating them. Do you have any other better method?
Well, the problem with centipedes is more accessibility. They tend to run around in wall voids. They tend to like things damper, so it's not that unusual to see them in the basement, but if you've got a bunch of boxes and things stored, often the question is you can't get to all the nooks and crannies you need to. Now, they are slow to breed, and generally you're never going to be totally overrun with them because they have to eat insects. And so if you don't tolerate a lot of insects in the house, there's not much centipede food, and so they just kind of limp along. But to totally eradicate them is not the easiest thing. The product you've got is good, and I would tell you the only problem with spraying concrete in the basement is it doesn't hold up very well, so I would restrict my spraying to wood beams and other things where the product will last much longer. Another favorite piece of advice I give people is to use glue boards. These are these sticky cardboard products that you put down, and they have bigger ones for catching mice and rats, and you can use those. But you put those back in the nooks and crannies in the basement. If the centipedes are running around, they get caught on it. They physically get caught and die in very short order. And so it's kind of a passive trap, might be a way of putting it. And they do help to reduce the numbers. Now, if you wanted to get rid of them totally, then you start to talk about drilling in the walls and a bunch of other things that I don't think really are worth the effort. And so I would keep going the direction you've got. The sprays that you use once every 2 months is more than adequate because, indoors, these products last quite long when they're protected from sunlight in lots of moisture. And as I said, maybe use the glue boards. The other thing is keep things open, away from walls, that kind of stuff. And even dehumidifiers help to some degree because you're drying the environment, which they like less. But as far as eliminating them 100%, I'm not so sure that can be done, but you can definitely keep the numbers down to, one every 6 months type of thing is I think, a reasonable expectation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben, for your call, Roger. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's give George a chance on Washington Island. Hello, George.
Hello. We have a knapweed problem up here, and we found some things that they use in Montana. I was wondering if you ever heard of... knapweed weevils.
Yes. In fact, this is one of my colleague Mark Rents over in the Department of Agronomy also works with this because this is a form of biocontrol of weeds. And since he's a weed specialist, what I will tell you is they have had some glaring successes and they've had some somewhat disappointing treatments. It's all local situations, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, which is kind of the way biology usually is. And so the companies that are selling this maybe oversell it a little bit, you know, giving the indication it always works and it's just the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's worth looking at, but as I said, we've seen from Minnesota and some of the other states that have played with it, is you do get mixed results.
So my understanding is you need a license to get them or a permit?
You can check with the Department of Ag. I would be surprised if you do, because they probably already allow, you know, there are cases they've already been brought in the state. And that's usually, bringing them in the first time or whatnot is a thing. But definitely the people at the Department of Ag would be the people that would issue the permits if you need it. But for private citizens, for something like this, I'm guessing not, because they've already gotten USDA approval and they went through some other things. But they ultimately would be able to answer it. But I'm leaning that you as an individual would not need it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, George. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor, entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, as we talk about bugs and insects. Briefly, how would you characterize the eastern tent caterpillar population?
Well, you know, we're through with the season. It's one generation a year, and we see the activity in May and June. In some parts of the central part of the state and whatnot, it was moderately impressive. I mean, the numbers were above normal. In other parts of the state, it wasn't anything unusual, but that's such an easily seen insect. You see the tents, you see the cherry trees have been stripped. So, you know, it catches people's attention. So, you know, nothing out of the ordinary, but I would say that it was above a normal year if I had to give it a rating.
We're going to continue our conversation with Phil Pelletieri after we check the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon as we continue talking about bugs and insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And again, Phil, thanks very much for being here. I know you've been busy the last couple of days with farm technology days and saw an awful lot of people. What was the sort of the mood of people that you talked to?
No, pretty reasonable. You know, and the one thing I will say is it is amazing to me when I go out and do a show like this, the number of people that stop by that listen to public radio. And so that's, you know, very encouraging. And I thank them for their nice words, but, you know, the cool weather in the scheme of things, you know, if I had to make a judgment right now, this has not been a bad bug year at all. You know, we've got some gypsy moths and some of the typical things, but we've not been overrun by anything in particular. And even the Japanese beetles are down. I'm watching just what's going on in my own yard. Is the numbers seem to be down moderate compared to what we've seen in some years. Now, I'm a little hesitant because of the cooler weather. I mean, if we had a week of 85 degrees and they were still living this way, I would really have a big smile on my face. So it still may surge on us, but overall, the weather, because insects are cold-blooded, the cooler it is, the slower everything seems to happen, and it does tend to keep a lid on some of these things.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest. Let's go to the phones. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234, and Mike is up next. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Go ahead. Two questions, guys, and good show, by the way. I had the opportunity to remove a piece of my vinyl siding, and when I did, object fell out of there that must have been insect made. It looked like a green thin cigar about the size of a cigarette, but looked like leaves rolled up overlapping. Any idea what that is?
Well, my first guess, there is an animal we call a leaf cutter bee, and they usually use straw-like or tube-like environments, and they line them with the cut leaves and lay their eggs and put pollen in there. This, to be honest, is what causes the problems for people with cedar siding when the woodpeckers are just pounding and creating holes all over. They're going after the leafcutter bees.
I have that problem too.
Yeah, they're going after the leafcutter bee grubs that are in there. And now, other than that, you know, for vinyl, it shouldn't be that much of an issue. And I don't really get that many complaints about woodpeckers picking on vinyl. You know, if things were caulked and sealed and there was no straw-like environment, they wouldn't be there. But I don't think there's anything to worry about.
Yeah, well, I have vinyl siding on my workshop, but I have cedar siding on my house, and the woodpeckers, and I'm wondering what they were after in there, so maybe the beetles are going or there. The second thing is, I was in the middle part of the state on 94 a week or so ago, and I stopped at a wayside, and there was a planter about 4 feet in diameter, and there was these insects flying over that I noticed, and it looked like orange and black wasps, about an inch, inch and a quarter long. And they would land on the ground in this planter and go into these holes. And I don't know if they were making the holes or excavating them or after something in the holes, because they would just stick in there and then sand would fly out of the holes, and then they'd come back out and go back and forth. And any idea what those would be?
Well, you know, as a group, they refer to them as digger wasps. And I don't know which species, but typically they will create a burrow, and then they'll either collect crickets or katydids or other types of insects and provision that. So they put this food in there, lay their eggs, and then again, they leave it be so that the grubs develop on their own. So it's not a true nest per se, but you can sometimes have 8 or 10 burrows in the same planter, and they're looking for loose soil type things. We've got some of these that catch beetles. In fact, the Department of Ag and DNR were looking into a particular species that seems to be pretty good at catching emerald ash borers, and they were wondering if they could use this as a monitoring tool. If you found where these wasps are, you dig up the area, or the trick you do is you put in what we call an excluder, so that whatever they're carrying, they can't burrow. It's up on the top. You observe it. And some research out of the East suggests that this is more efficient than any traps that we can come up with, and so that's what's so appealing about it. So I definitely know it's that kind of wasp. These, we would call them solitary wasps because they don't live in nests. In general, solitary wasps, although they're capable of stinging, are very non-aggressive because they have no nest to defend. And so it'd just be a question of, again, what particular species and what they were collecting to feed their young.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Tracy's next in Eau Claire. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My first I have two questions for you. The first one is in regards to moles. I know that grubs tend to attract moles. However, I haven't been seeing grubs per se. Is there something else that would be attracting moles to my garden?
Earthworms.
And then earthworms.
And this is a dilemma because some people are applying pesticide to the lawns to kill the grubs to make the moles go away. And if they've got earthworms there, the pesticides won't kill the earthworms. They still have the problem, and we've misused, but use an insecticide we don't need. So, yeah, if you've got good rich soil, you've got a lot of night crawlers, the earthworms are taking, or I mean, the moles are taking advantage of that.
That makes sense because I've had a serious decline in the earthworm population in my garden.
And that's probably why.
And then the second question is, what can I do organically to eliminate the cucumber beetle from my garden? He's a real problem this year.
It gets a little bit handcuffed, but two products that will kill adult cucumber beetles and are organic. There's an old insecticide called Rotenone, which is a dust or a spray that's a stomach poison. To be honest, Rotenone's relatively toxic. I mean, this is one of these classic examples of a product that you can use it. You wait 3 or 4 days is the normal thing. It breaks down. But one of the considerations, even though it's organic, it's somewhat toxic. There's another product that really is very good for a number of things, and it's pretty good for cucumber beetles. I know the product as spinosad. It's an insecticide that's derived from an organism that was found underneath a rum still in Jamaica. And it gives off a compound almost like an antibiotic that is great for killing caterpillars and pretty good for killing some beetles. And what's really neat is it's become available in a lot of the garden stores. One of the names it's sold under is Entrust, E-N-T-R-U-S-T. Another name is Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Juice. That one's easy to remember. A third name is Monterey's Vegetable and Fruit Spray. Monterey's a company that tends to specialize in more organic-type products. And then finally, if you ever ordered from Gardens Alive, it's their Bullseye Insecticide. So the spinosad, it's a pretty good product. To be honest, it's very good for Colorado potato beetles. It's not quite as good for cucumber beetles, but it is an organic product, and it does have some efficacy.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Tracy, thanks very much for the call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 as we continue talking with Phil Pelletieri. Let's go next to Gene in Milwaukee. Hi, Gene. What's on your mind
today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I sail on Lake Michigan, and sometimes you're 20, 30 miles out, and you're inundated with swarms of black biting flies. They have not accompanied me out there. They appear out there, and I wonder about their life cycle.
We call them stable flies. They're also referred to as heel flies and dog ear flies. They breed in basically wet hay, but they also can breed in seaweed. But one of the interesting things is we know from marking and recapture studies that these flies can come from 20 or 30 miles away. And one of the phenomena that you will see with the lake is they often pile up along the lakeshore, and I think that's a thermal thing. You know, mm-hmm. the differences in temperatures, they sense that, but they can be found very far away from any potential site, and they're highly attracted to movement. These are the flies that typically, when you're out on the beach, you come out and they bite you on the heels. And in fact, for livestock, they call them heel flies because they're quite common on the lower legs too. And they are very aggressive biters, very painful biters. They look like a biting housefly. That might be the best way to describe them because their shape and color is very similar to a housefly. But if you look at the front end of it, it's this mean-looking beak-like saber versus a housefly has a sponge-like mouth part.
Gene?
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
All right.
Know how that got way out there, but I didn't know that they traveled 20, 30 miles.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, Gene, good luck to you. Thanks for the call. And let's go to Frank in Arborvitae. Hello, Frank.
Hi. Good day, gentlemen. Have a older blacktop driveway here. I've had it repaved once, but there's always some cracks or holes or whatnot that a little ant finds. And so what I call pavement ants are bring up sand piles, quite a few, all over the place. Is there a good way to get rid of them?
Well, a couple things. There is something called a pavement ant, but honestly, it's more likely to be in your house. It's a European species that's been moving in here. If I took a wild guess, it's either a cornfield ant or a field ant. But it doesn't matter what the species is. The treatment is very similar. For any ant nest, there is a queen that's down in the ground. And the secret to control is to get to the queen. Now, what a lot of people will do is powder or lightly spray the surface. They may stop being active for a short period of time, but usually in a matter of days or weeks, they seem to be active again. And all they've really done is kind of go underground. And so what works better, honestly, is to mix up a liquid and drench it or soak it on. Now, if the cracks are big enough, to be honest, I sometimes like to use a small tube or something to put a burrow down in there, you know, so that when I pour the stuff, it goes deeper than just soaking in. If that's not available, it's just cracks. As I said, what I would do is mix up something liquid. You'll probably notice most of the garden insecticides you might have in the garage are labeled for ants, but I like a liquid formulation in this case. If I had to go buy something, there's a common old insecticide that's been around for a long time called Sevin, S-E-V-I-N, and it has some really interesting toxicity to ants. And so when I have to go get something, that's often a product I'm looking for. And as I said, I mix it up in a small bucket or coffee can, it depends on the size, and just pour it in slowly so it keeps soaking and keeps soaking, and you'll find that your treatments will be more effective if you do that.
Now, I have a bag of Sevin, but it's powder.
Yeah, and the problem there is that if you put it on and apply water, you're not going to get it near as deep as if you had. Now, if it's the wettable powder,
yeah.
Not the dust, if it's the wettable powder, then you mix it according to normal directions, and it will suspend. You got to kind of shake things a bit to keep it in suspension, but then it will go deeper. If it's just the dust form, which is a 5% dust, it's hard to wash that stuff in.
No, this is like 50% or something.
Yeah, so just follow the
orchard spray.
Yeah, so just follow the normal dilution rates. You know, of it's probably 1 tablespoon to a gallon or something similar. But in this case, you mix it and don't use the sprayer as much as I said, I find using some kind of container where I can slowly pour it on so it just kind of slowly seeps and soaks is where it will work the best.
We'll give it a try. Thank you.
Frank, thanks very much. Good luck to you. There in Arborvitae, and we go next to Gordon in Greenfield. And Gordon, what can we do for you?
Hi. I got a problem with these, I think they're centipedes. I'm in a lower apartment, and they're really quick, and they run around here. Mm-hmm. And I even found one in the sink the other day. I wonder why they're here.
Well, centipedes are hunters. They go out and hunt for insects, and one of the things when people say a centipede to me, my first question in the back of my mind, we've got some that live indoors. Those are the big long-legged ones that are real quick. But we also have common ones outdoors under rocks and in leaf litter. And so the question is, are they outdoor species migrating in and just getting mixed up? Or are they the indoor species that we call them house centipedes because they don't normally live outdoors in Wisconsin, but they can live in the warm environments that we create. We had talked earlier in the show, you know, somebody had called in about them. You never get overrun by them because there's not enough food to support high populations, but they are nighttime hunters. People often think they come out of the drain pipes or whatnot, but what's happening is when they're running around, they get into a sink and they can't crawl out that smooth surface, and so they kind of get trapped in the bathtub or the like. And again, in general, the higher you go in the building, the drier it is, the less centipedes you see, although you can find them on the fifth floor of an apartment, but in general, I'm looking for them in the basement and first floor in most cases. They do respond to sprays. They do respond to light dusting back in the corners. But you usually have to go back in these kind of quiet places, back in closets, back underneath the refrigerator. You know, I tell people it's not worth spraying in the middle of or treating the middle of the kitchen floor or the middle of the living room, because that's not where they are 99% of the time. They're hiding back into places. And the other thing we had talked about for people that prefer not the chemicals, the glue boards, the physical traps. You put those back. You got to be careful. You got kids and pets because you don't want your cat getting into a glue board. But again, you can usually squeeze them underneath things in places, and that's probably where the centipedes will be anyway. And if anyone's foolish enough to crawl across it, they will be get caught. In the normal centipede, the indoor centipede probably has about a 2-year life cycle. So as I said, there are not many of them there, and if you can remove the important breeding adults, you can knock them down pretty quick.
Wow. Thank you. I really feel like I'm an expert on centipedes now.
Now you have to go take care of them, Gordon. Thanks very much for your call. As we continue with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. And Paul is next in Duluth. Paul, what can we do for you?
Hi, guys. Hi, Phil. I heard a news report about forest tent caterpillars a couple of weeks ago, and it sent a chill up my spine because I'm an avid gardener, and I've seen what they can do. Give me your prediction. Put on your hat. I heard that it's going to be an El Nino winter here, which typically means warmer temperatures and possibly more snowfall, and that seems like it would be to their advantage. Do you think that we're going to have a major outbreak? I'm in Duluth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we're going to have a major outbreak this next year?
Well, this one isn't as weather-dependent as you might think. They overwinter as egg cases that are always above the snow line. They're laid on twigs and the like. And so it's true, if I knew we were going to have a 45 below, that might start to get cold enough. But, I mean, these insects are quite common in central Ontario and whatnot, so they're really pretty tolerant and cold hardy. We were talking earlier, somebody had mentioned they thought they were seeing a bit of a buildup, and this is what it usually is a 3 or 4 year buildup. But what seems to cause the populations to go up and down are their natural parasites and predators. And when they get out of whack, they tend to build, and then the friendly fly, or what some people call the government fly up north, is one of the primary natural controls. So when they're not doing their job, the tent caterpillars get out of hand. When they do show up, they are the ultimate control that knocks them out. Again, both the Wisconsin DNR and the Minnesota DNR do go up and do egg mass surveys. And I haven't seen anything, but to be honest, I've been busy enough with the day-to-day stuff. I haven't been keeping up with this probably as much as I should. But you should be able to go on the DNR sites in August and September when they start to do kind of their yearly summaries. And they'll tell you what kind of egg masses they're finding. If they start to see a large number, it may be a problem. If they don't find many eggs or they're not reporting it, that suggests there's no eggs there and there's nothing to worry about.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Paul, thank you very much for your call. And let's give Mary a chance in Marshfield. Hello, Mary.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Last night I was out in our orchard, and I saw some small, they looked like worms. They were about a quarter to a half inch on the leaves of our pear trees. I picked them up, and they were easy to crush.
Were they shiny looking? Were they, what colored were they?
Yeah, they were dark brown to black, and they were kind of shiny looking.
Okay. There's a critter called a pear slug, and it's not a slug, it's really a sawfly. But it excretes its waste on its back, and so that's why it's got that slimy, gooey look. When they just feed on the surface of the leaf, so you get these brownish or silverish patches, which eventually brown. And they feed on a variety of things, amelanchier and purple leaf plum and pear. The good news is the damage is very cosmetic. I mean, unless every leaf was just crawling with them, I don't think it's going to cause much damage. To be honest, you're pretty observant because most of the people I talk to catch it about 2 weeks too late. You know, they didn't know anything was feeding. By the time they look at the leaves, they can't find any worms and they're past the point. Even these guys sound pretty close to being full grown. They don't get that big. Half inch-ish or so is normal. Drop to the ground, they spin little cocoons. So I'm guessing that you're not going to have to worry unless, as I said, you're averaging a couple critters per leaf.
Okay, so I don't have to spray them?
No. And you could kill them with soapy water, insecticidal soap, okay. And most insecticides. They're really not resistant or difficult to kill. It's usually a timing issue for most people.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for the call. And let's go to Deborah in Milwaukee. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about these little bugs that they're really tiny little teeny-weeny. They look, but they're hard. And then when you kill them, they stink. And they're in birch trees. And I brought one to the brought one to Havenwood State Forest, and a couple people looked at it, and they didn't know what it was.
Sure.
And
you know what was the secret is when you said birch, because there's a little animal that we call a birch catkin bug. Catkin is the seed pod that's on a birch tree. So these are birch seed bugs, and they are a sucking insect. They suck the starches out of the seed, so that's how they get their nutrition. But being in the true bug group, many of the true bugs have scent glands, and they stink like high heaven if you crush them. Once in a while, if the birch tree is close to your house, the little stinkers kind of wander in, but they can't breed. They just kind of hanging out and stuff. Don't cause the birch any suffering other than if you were growing birch for seed. Then it would be considered a pest. But on the average birch tree, that's not much of an issue. Once in a great while, I've seen a cluster of mono leaf, and the leaf will curl, but it's, you know, one leaf out of 1,000, so it's no big deal. So,
well, there were hundreds on this. I mean, there was just so many. It was they were on everything. But what I noticed is that katydids like them. So last year, now they're at two different houses, but last year, there was tons of katydids in the house, on the door, and they were out there. I just love katydids. So with the bugs, you get the katydids. But now I don't see katydids this year, but I see bats in the backyard. So do bats eat katydids?
Bats like flying insects, so anything that's in the air they will go after. And there is a couple bats that will forage, but usually not. Katydids is not their prime thing. It's moths and some of those other things are really more in the bats' diet. And it's more circumstantial, because I normally wouldn't correlate katydid numbers to birch catkin bug numbers.
But, oh, really? So maybe, I don't know, then maybe the katydids were like to hang out in the birch tree to eat something else?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We had an email from Diane in Houston, Minnesota. We've had something in the edges of our crank-out windows. Looks like hay above the windows when we open it. The insects appears to be light green, large wings, and when we put one into a baggie once, it later turned into an ugly grub. What are they? How can we prevent them?
Well, it is a similar story. We had talked about these digger wasps and the like, and we also talked about leafcutter bees. There are other species of wasp that will go out and collect grass and whatnot to use to line the inside of their nests. And then, you know, most of the wasps that do this are predators. They go out and collect various prey, which is usually insects, and put it in these structures and lay their egg. And then a grub will develop because what I think she saw was the food source. And eventually the egg hatched, and the grub that's feeding on that food source is what came out. Sometimes in the winter when you're changing windows, you'll find them and you'll just see the little cocoons. That's how these things get through the winter. And then in the spring of the year, if left undisturbed, they'll transform into the wasps and go and fly out. So really not a whole lot to worry about. Usually you start to wonder about the physical fitting of a window. Sometimes windows have, you know, various seams and the like, and you can start talk about, you know, light screening or something else so that insects, because these insects are about an inch and a half long, can't squeeze through. I mean, you can just kind of physically keep them out. You don't need to do that, you know. And I think this is a little more common in older windows just because the way they fit, it gives more spacing. But what so many of these things are looking for is an environment. And again, what they're seeing is a straw-like tube where they want to provision their nest, and they're finding that. So the secret to keeping away is to prevent their access.
And if you had to describe the gypsy moth population in the state this summer, what would you say?
Briefly, they were moderate in numbers. A lot of people ran into them in numbers for the first time. But until I get the reports from the Department of Ag from their moth catch surveys, in Madison, we saw quite a few, but the sprays were quite disappointing here. And this happens sometimes is that just the way the weather is, you can't get good sprays. I didn't have a lot of people in tears. That's very encouraging. And so, as I said, I don't see that they really exploded. I was hoping for more disease, and there may be more disease out there than I know of, because, again,
we'll
I didn't
get
a lot
go.
Of defoliation yet.
Thank you so much, Phil Pelletieri, for being here today. We'll look forward to your next appearance. Tomorrow at 11, it'll be Garden Talk with Kristen Krokowski of Waukesha, the Waukesha County Extension Commercial Horticulture Educator. And thanks for listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.